Well, good afternoon. My name's Jim Marks, and I'm from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and I'm going to not use slides, and I'm not going to talk much about data. I do want to comment on a couple of elements that, and I know this is an epidemiologic audience, and you're used to data, but bear with me. I'm going to comment on a few of the points made by the previous speakers. First, they both talked about that there's lots unknown in the data that we gather, the needs we have for longitudinal and surveillance systems. The meta message of the IOM report that we asked for and they agreed was the case was, in fact, we know enough to act, that the science maybe could get better, the science should get better, we need to continue to invest in it, but we know enough to act, and that if we act and apply what we know, that is all of the sectors apply what we know and what they have responsibility for, we can be quite confident that we will get the change we need in obesity. That's a crucial message. That's a crucial message to come from a largely scientific body, and it was a different statement than was made by the IOM on its first report about 7 years earlier. I say that because I want to emphasize that point. There will always be the tension between the scientists who say more research is necessary and the advocates who says, geez, this is really so important, we got to act on it now. It's something that we do in almost every field, and I'll come back to that. But that's the unresolvable tension between science and advocacy and policy. The other part of it is, and this was in Bob's about the quality of life. Really, if you remember that list of diseases he had, almost all of those were really quality of life diseases more than mortality diseases. And as such, there are many ways the quality of life can be affected. Both conditions and the focuses of both speakers were really on the fundamental notion we can, and we often do, become very reductionistic as to does the physical activity from dancing help lower obesity rates? How about from walking? How about from jogging? How about? And the answer, of course, is yeah, they all do. We need to have a society that has health as one of its fundamental purposes. So then you look at, does this policy, this change, this recommendation improve health? The other part of it was that many of the measures they talked about as being needed are largely outside of the responsibility of medical care or even public health as traditionally practiced. Those are some of the meta messages that I heard from them, and now as I lead into discussion of policy and advocacy. It's great. I'm not going to have to talk about chronic diseases much. You've heard already a lot about it, about the burden. But what's clear is our nation's ability to prevent or delay the onset of these conditions and treat them effectively at relatively low costs are increasingly being perceived as crucial to our long-term economic competitiveness. Since some of the most important causes of these conditions, whether you think of it by risks, tobacco, alcohol, obesity, almost all of them are heavily affected by public policy and community environments, and so it can be expected that their prevention will require changes in policy. It is epidemiologic and other population science that's often the basis for understanding the relationship of the causes specific health outcomes or chronic diseases here, and in evaluating potential solutions, including those related to policy and environment. So the role of epidemiologic and public health science and public policy has been a challenging discussion for our discipline, and I'm going to talk about the issues of measurement, disparity, and societal context for implications of epidemiology and public policy. My job, that is to try to bridge the need for policy change that supports health in a community or state or nation and a science, epidemiology, that is well suited for informing policy, but in a science culture in which we worry that embracing an advocacy approach as scientists to create policy change may lead to people questioning our objectivity as scientists. And that's a fundamental tension for our field. Creating societal change to improve the health of the public is the central role of public health. Let's be real clear about that. Creating societal change to improve the health of the public is the central role of public health. Now, I did not say that about epidemiology specifically, and there's a distinction to be made here. But I want to touch briefly on what is public policy before we get into the meat of the talk. I'm not going to give you a textbook definition, but at its core, public policy is the way a society frames what it wishes to become. Does it want all children immunized? Does it want to greatly limit the use of tobacco? Does it wish to do more or do better for the vulnerable or underserved? Policy doesn't have to be federal. It can be state or local. It doesn't have to be law or regulation. It can be policies in an organization. APHA has a policy related to food, to labor, all of those sorts of things. How does this fit with epidemiology and its history? That is, this public orientation, as Manley said, this activist sense of our field. Some of it's obvious in retrospect. It's highly unlikely that John Snow would be revered in public health like he is if he had merely studied the geographic distribution of cholera deaths in London. His defining moment, at least in the classic story, is that he removed the pump handle from the contaminated well that he thought was the source of the epidemic. From the very beginning, our heroes have been tied to action. In 1983, Bill Foege, the former director of CDC and soon to be president of APHA, gave the Wade Hampton Frost lecture on epidemiology to the epidemiology section here at APHA. There he coined the term consequential epidemiology when he talked about using the tools of epidemiology ultimately to change what happens to the health and lives of people. Epidemiology is persuasive. Persuasive should lead to logical consequences. At that time in 1983, almost 30 years ago, he was taking sides in an active debate at the time in our field. He was saying epidemiology is a tool to change the world, not merely to study the world. The debate that he was speaking to was whether epidemiologists should engage in the political process in advocating solutions about what should happen based on the science or merely to do the science and let the advocates and policymakers use the science or not. Some said that scientists would lose their objectivity if they took on this role or have their objectivity impugned by others because they had a point of view about what should be done. They worried that the high regard of science would be at risk if its practitioners took a position about what should be done by policymakers. Now, there was a lot of nuance in that debate, and there still is. For example, many times the science might be immature or incomplete when decisions are called for, and yet there could still be important things that public health scientists, epidemiologists have to say on particular health issues. This discussion periodically comes back, more recently, quite strongly, in the context of the politicization of science. Politics and public policy can be a tough business, with the impugning of motives and character as likely as the impugning of data, especially recently. But Bill Foege was of a very clear opinion. It was his conviction that public health was inherently political, inescapably political. Public health work occurs in a political context. He's argued and that divorced from that context, our science is stillborn, a missed opportunity. To pretend otherwise is self-delusion and a failure of vision and responsibility. So if I have a single purpose in talking before you, it's to reaffirm that connection to activism and to remind you that you are fully lineal descendants, not just of the shoe leather epidemiologists, but also of the pump handle removing ones. I state this not despite the recent concerns about politicization of science, but because of them. One of the reasons that this was a difficult talk for me to structure and to get my thoughts clear about is because we actually have to embrace the space between activism and commitment to social change as central to public health and the central purpose of epidemiologic science, which is different. The central purpose of epidemiology is to find, assess, and confirm truth, regardless of past findings or past beliefs, and these are different roles. But the space between public health as activism for social change and epidemiology as assessing the knowledge is where the real excitement is. Actions are being taken based on science as is known so far, and actions will change as science advances. It's not unlike an oncologist with a patient with cancer in front of him or her. The science is improving. In a few years, it may be better than what they have, but they have to act now and do the best they can for that patient in front of them. I also want some context as well in a broader perspective. It's impossible to talk about public health, medical care, and not talk about the economics of where we are. Very bluntly, we're in a period of convulsion that is likely to change the very nature of medical care in America, the largest industry in our nation, and a central issue in our global economic competitiveness, where we now spend twice what other developed countries do on average per capita per year. It's almost impossible to think of major changes in the medical care system that don't get linked to public policy changes, the Affordable Care Act being only the most recent example. And that's despite the idea that it's biologic science that's the basis for improvements in diagnosis and therapy, which is often the idea that's in front of the public. But it's in fact what we cover and how much we'll pay for it and who we cover that are really the discussions that are at the core of public policy. Now think about public health and what causes illness or good health. What happens in agriculture, whether it's the food itself or how good it is for you or not, how it's raised with or without antibiotics or chemicals, how safe it is and the risk of injury to workers and farmers. Or how about what happens in transportation, injuries and their prevention, the role of alcohol there, seatbelts, airbags, or transportation policy that has implications for activity like support for walking and biking, or in tobacco or in housing. All of these areas are really important for health, and they're largely outside of the responsibility of the public health agency officially, or certainly the medical care system. So the public's health and the societal factors that affect health span a much greater proportion of our economy and our society than even medical care does. So, of course, we'll have to address things that have political implications. Many of us, most of the public, most of our policymakers have not been nearly as aware of and accordingly have not as committed to the understanding that how our society is organized, what our policies foster or inhibit, what our communities encourage and our institutions support are equally fundamental causes of good or ill health warranting study or action. They may be directly in the causal chain, they may not be, but even if they're not directly in the causal chain, they influence the distribution of illness in our society and are core reasons why the differential distribution that we find for almost any disease is so hard to change, because we have to change the fundamental policies and structures of our society. And if our societal forces are not in alignment, scientific advances stall, and the value realized is a meager fraction of its potential. Scientific understandings about any disease that are not widely applied to the people who need them are ultimately wasted, whether that's epidemiologic or biologic science. Similarly, though, the widespread application of practices and policies that have no scientific evidence of effectiveness are just as futile. Scientific discovery and widespread application can never be separated, as each bears little fruit without the other. So this is a defining tension for us in our field. Scientists never feel they know enough. More research is necessary. And as I said, practitioners and advocates say that the issues they're so passionate about are so important, we must act now. We can't wait for better science. It's research that turns disease and injury from fate's misfortune or bad luck or accident into biologic understanding and potential control. But that research turns its understanding over to society, and it's the policies that must transform that understanding into impact on disease, how much is prevented or treated. And it's the policies that will determine if disparity will be diminished because of targeting application to those in greatest need, or if disparity widens because of great application to those with means or access more than need. The achievement of science is to convert fate into a societal choice. It's societal policy and action that determines the ultimate impact and value of that scientific advancement. So our past leaders are revered for action, have called for an activist, consequential orientation to the field of epidemiology, and that public health as a field as a whole is about social change. What does this mean for the field of epidemiology directly? You've actually heard a little bit from our earlier speakers. The role of epidemiology in society is to measure aspects of health, identify differences worthy of note and concern, and draw attention to them. To the extent that epidemiologists have a rallying cry, it is what gets measured gets done. But I'm going to give you a slightly different version. I'm going to quote a woman named Donella Meadows. She's an environmentalist from the Pacific Northwest who said it much more eloquently, especially given today's discussion. She said that the indicators a society chooses to report to itself about itself are surprisingly powerful. They reflect the collective values and inform collective decision. A nation that keeps a watchful eye on its salmon runs or the safety of its streets makes different choices than does a nation that's only paying attention to gross domestic product. So more than any other group in health, epidemiologists decide what is measured regarding the health of the nation. We choose what questions are asked and analyzed, what differences are important or serious, worthy of comment, or even alarm. If you don't ask the questions, the only answer is silence. It's a position of huge responsibility and equally large opportunity to profoundly affect the national debate about health. And at its most powerful, this is about asking questions of the most fundamental, often the most difficult to measure aspects of health, wellness, and even happiness and life satisfaction that comprise the fullness of the WHO definition of health, and how that vision of health ties to our nation's highest ideals of equality of opportunity. Public health practice and policy is about applying what's known so far. It's never about saying that the science is complete. What does this mean? The scientist, the epidemiologist, must be free to speak about what she or he has learned, what their research findings suggest, and even as they have the responsibility to be true to what the data show. Public health and the rest of the public health process, including policy, will play out and use those findings more or less within a societal and political context. Those are the practitioners and the advocates who work in the large and small P area of politics. But you saw the maps about obesity, incredibly visual and powerfully so. It was an epidemiologist who first developed those, Ali Mukhtar at CDC. If you don't know, a few years before he developed those maps, and they came out in JAMA in 1999, there was a paper in the American Journal of Public Health using the same data system, the BRFSS, that showed an increasing line in obesity in the states. I don't know that it was ever cited again. The display of data is equally powerful. The notion about the differences in life expectancy by zip code. The first time I saw that was in a commission that we, the foundation, supported to build a healthier America. We had hearings in three cities, and in each city, we drew a map of the area. And in Washington, D.C., we showed the life expectancy in the inner city, 72, and the life expectancy at the end of the metro lines. And on average, they were 8 to 9 years. 20 miles or so on average, 9 years difference. If you don't know, life expectancy increases about 0.2 years per calendar year. So the inner city, it's as if they were 40 to 45 years behind the end of the metro line. And of course, where are the best hospitals and doctors located? Maybe in the academic centers in the center of city. This was not about geographic access. Oh, I almost forgot to mention, it seems that Jon Snow didn't actually remove the pump handle. In a recent history of the Jon Snow epidemic called the Ghost Map, the author said that on September 7, 1854, Jon Snow presented his findings to the Board of Governors of the St. James Parish. And it was they who, after much discussion, because the Broad Street pump was so widely known for the good qualities of its water, nevertheless voted to close the well down because the evidence was so strong. In some ways, it makes Jon Snow even more of a hero in our field, because even he had to use his data to persuade the policymakers. I want to tie some of these together. During the past decade, we've added about $1 trillion annually to our medical care budget and lost ground in life expectancy and infant mortality relative to other countries. They are getting healthier faster than we are, despite our great increase in dollars devoted to medical care. We seem to have tried to catch up in health by spending more and more, faster and faster, on medical care. We're going to have to find another way. Perhaps it's time for public health and prevention. In 1986, Bill Foege, who was by then no longer CDC director, but was the president of APHA, in his presidential address, he stood and spoke to us, and things were not all that different from the way they are now. The economy then was just coming out of recession. There were ballooning deficits and malfunctioning markets. And he had this to say: because of the way the market system works, the special clientele of APHA will continue to be the poor, the homeless, the unimmunized, the hungry, the addicted, and those that simply find the system overwhelming. Let me assure you, we will survive any crisis that involves funding, political support, popularity, or cyclic trends. But we cannot survive the internal crisis if we become provincial, focused totally on the short term, if we lose our philosophy of social justice. It is your purpose in public health and your responsibility as epidemiologists to add your weight to that, so that social justice is achieved more quickly and more completely. So your final and fundamental challenge being in the field of public health, a challenge that only you can respond to, is that regardless of what illnesses or conditions or risks you work on, that you have to have the epidemiology of injustice and disparity in health prominent in your reports. Our overarching goal is to reduce and eliminate differences in health, and what gets measured gets done. That means you must, even if you don't engage in the public discourse yourself, you must measure justice. Thank you.
Jim, that was outstanding. Thank you very much. I think many of us recognize that, as we started with, epidemiology should be an action-oriented science. It can't be dry. It can't be a practicum. It's not an exercise and an internship. It's a lifelong dedication to translating data into actionable items. So with that being said, I'd like to open up the floor to a more Socratic sort of dialogue with our discussants here. I will take chair's privilege and toss the first one out. And I'm going to move away from here. I hate being behind the podium.
Some of you
have
been at the ABA. I'm all over the floor.
Speak up, then.
I will be very loud. When we look at the changes that have occurred over the last 20 years, we notice that exercise has gone down, caloric intake has gone up, and that seemed to have changed right around the 80s. Can you address what were the fundamental changes? Why did exercise go down? Why did caloric intake go up? And why did a dramatic increase in obesity occur?
simple problem, and there's no simple answer to this.
I'm going to use the mic because I don't project as well. I think a variety of changes occurred simultaneously, you know, increase in technology, increase in media access, increase in portion sizes, increase in, you know, more foods and beverages available, changes in our school environments. I mean, I described our recommendations as being systems oriented, and it's going to require efforts on the part of everyone, and the same thing with the obesity epidemic and problem. The warning signs were there for years, but when you had sort of the collective integration of improved technology, increased access to processed foods, people have less time available during the day, they're more likely to go to fast food outlets, it's simpler, it's easier, in some cases it's a lot cheaper for some people, even though the data doesn't necessarily back that up. So there have been a variety of factors that have contributed to this. It wasn't just one simple solution. I don't know if anybody else wants to add anything else too.
I'll add a little. This is a question I asked of a med school class at Harvard. This will help show the age of the audience or the lack thereof. How many of you ever in your life had to get up to change a TV station? If you ask that of a med school class at Harvard, no hands go up unless someone got in at a late life change. We have engineered out physical activity, and engineering it out is a systems change. We've engineered in convenience in food and portion size, and we've created our policies to make food that is high calorie cheap for us. So if you don't know, if you grow fresh fruits and vegetables, there's no subsidy. If you grow fresh fruits and vegetables, there's also no crop insurance possible. You take on all of that risk yourself. Whereas if you grow corn or wheat or other commodity crops, you get to insure yourself at a subsidized rate in case there's bad weather or storm or whatever. We've made the changes are all system. They are complex, but they all add up. And that's why there's not going to be any single intervention that's going to turn it around. If you don't know, one of the things that I get asked when I give a talk on obesity in front of a non-public health group, I have to give the definition of obesity for children. What is it? It's weight for height that's greater than, or BMI, that's greater than the 95th percentile. And somebody in the audience says, well, how can that be? How can we have 20% of kids that are greater than the 95th percentile? And the answer is because when those curves were developed in the 1970s, there was only 5% greater, and now there's 20.
Thank you, Dr. Marks. That's excellent. That brings up the point that I wanted to bring, and thank you guys for that really nice underhanded softball pitch. We exist in a complex system. It requires systems theory and system thinking, and we as epidemiologists have not always got on that bandwagon. And I think now it is time to really share it with our other constituents in public health to do this. Can we open up to the floor? There are other questions.
Please. The IOM committee, did it include any educators? I direct a local public health agency and actually have been working with a group of leaders in our community from the healthcare system, actually ironically even from the third-party payer system, and from the school system. And everyone agrees they want to do what they can to improve the health of the community, including addressing obesity. But the educator, superintendent of our largest school system, said, don't put it on the backs of the schools. We can't do this. We are already under fire to do everything else with shrinking resources. So as you were commenting that, yes, we've got to include these policies, I guess I'm asking the question, are we as epidemiologists or public health practitioners considering these not so unintended consequences, making sure that as we recommend policies, we're also recommending the resources to ensure that those policies can move forward?
It's an excellent question. The committee did have several people who focused their research efforts and scientific efforts in the education sector. I don't know if I would consider them educators or not, superintendents and of school boards and things like that. Having said that, however, a lot of my research is specifically focused on policy changes in schools, and I interact with educators quite often, superintendents and other local school boards and things like that. And the first thing they say to me all the time is, you know, having all these policies is great, but I don't have the resources. I have these competing demands from No Child Left Behind and things like that. And what are some other strategies we can take to try and move the dial in terms of improving the school health environment, but at the same time, meet our competing demands? And it's an issue that the committee dealt with quite a bit. It's one of the reasons, you know, some people going in thought, well, maybe we should start with schools as sort of the only focus, you know, and we sort of came out of that committee saying schools are a key critical focal point, but they're not the only focal point. It cannot all be put on the backs of schools, exactly as you said, and that's what many members of that committee specifically stated throughout the process, because we all recognize that resources are incredibly tight, not just in this economic environment, but overall. And this issue of competing demands in terms of focusing on reading, writing, arithmetic, and you know, academic achievement and progress. What we also recognize, though, is there is data and there is research to back up the important link between a healthy child and a child who achieves higher academically. And so we felt that it was very important to be able to draw on that linkage. You know, somebody once said to me, Jamie, you know, you do a lot of this research looking at the linkage between these policies and BMI and weight outcomes. What about looking at the relationship with academic achievement and the extent to which these policies are correlated with changes in academic achievement? And it's something that I think we have to really start to hone in on so that educators can take this data back and say, look, these policies are not just going to help us improve maybe obesity and BMI and weight outcomes, but maybe they can help us better understand what it takes to be a healthy child and, you know, improve their academic progress. So I personally understand exactly where you're coming from, and I can assure you that a number of members of the committee also did the same. We felt we would have been extremely remiss in not including schools, given that children spend, you know, the majority of their waking day for at least 9 months a year, depending on where they live, in the school environment. And so the schools play a critical role, but they are not the only sector that we need to focus on, which is why our recommendations were broad-based across all sectors.
Wanted to respond to Bob,
please. Yeah. So very quickly, thanks for that. Having loitered around Institute of Medicine for too long, I can tell you that there are a lot of educators and a lot of people with communication skills that end up on the committees, and there was one on mine, so at least one. And so we do try to attend to that. But I think I wanted to take off for just one quick second on your comment about the burdens of the school system and trying to invoke policies through the schools. And I think that's an adverse effect of various policies, actually. There's only so much oxygen out there, to use an old political metaphor. And you can only push so hard, after which you are kicking out other kinds of equally worthy policies. And I think that's an adverse effect.
I think I need to take another tack from there, partly, though I would be sympathetic to it. We support a program called the Alliance for a Healthier Generations Healthy Schools Program. It's a recognition program for schools that if they make enough policy changes, they can reach bronze, silver, gold recognition. 15,000 schools are participating. About 1,000 have made, 900 have made bronze or higher. We've done several studies. Schools in poor neighborhoods, schools with a high proportion of children that have free or reduced lunch eligibility are just as likely to make changes. So there are resource constraints. I don't think the resource constraints are fundamental to making many changes that are possible in schools. I don't mean to belittle the pressures that schools are under. They're under a lot of pressure. And they're under pressure that is financial. I think there is still a lot that can be done and depends on one's focus. Are you focusing on what they can't do? The single least likely policy change that's made is reinstituting physical education, because that really is costly. But there are lots of other things that they can do. They can take out, as probably has happened in this school, they can take out sugar-sweetened beverages from vending machines and not see a decline in the revenue. Let's face it, vending machines are the equivalent of the ongoing bake sale for principals. It gives them ongoing money of a very modest amount, but it's probably the only sort of flexible money they have.
I think we have time for one more question for the panel.
Has there ever been any studies done looking at the weight of the nation in relationship to the fear of the nation? Because there really has been a huge shift in parenting from the time, at least when the gentleman and I were growing up. Kids used to run out and play all day long. But what with, in the change of the late 80s and 90s with Columbine and the like, many parents were fearful of their children going outside of the door.
So when you ask parents, that is one of their big fears. There's no question about that, as you might expect, especially so in poor neighborhoods. We did host a meeting with at CDC or with CDC, the Injury Center and the Obesity Group, to look at how serious this was and were there interventions about that. There aren't very many good interventions about it, but it was roundly recognized as a serious issue for families that would like their children to be more active.
I think it's true of older women too. Very low exercise rates, and I think there's a lot of fears, founded or not.
Let's face it. We know that if an older person is diagnosed with diabetes, say under the Affordable Care Act, they get insurance that's as good as a member of Congress. They can get their medications, their screenings. They're also going to be told they need to eat better and get exercise. If they live in a neighborhood where fresh fruits and vegetables aren't available, or it's unsafe or unsavory, they're not going to be able to make those changes to the same degree someone living elsewhere could.
That's a wonderful point, Jim. And I'd like to speak to that, too. I'm currently doing some research for a paper on the childhood sexual exploitation of children. And less than 15% of abductions occur at places like malls, state fairs, that sort of thing. 60% or more occur in parks and playgrounds. So their fears are very valid. And that's a very unfortunate reality. And you said something also, Jim, that I think is very appropriate. No matter how well we medicate someone, no matter how great a care that we give them, if they don't have access to the facilitators to make healthy behavior changes, then they will not make those changes. Well, I would sincerely like to thank all of you for coming today, and a big round for our discussion participants, too.